Gens.
So in other words, some idiot pays some ridiculous.
Who does, I think, is it the same as what is known as Carillion photography?
Yes.
And she will talk to us about Luminous. I'm not thinking of the right word. Anyway.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Exactly that.
Yeah.
Journeys into the light fields of plants. And it's really nice to be here. I know Jake from our history with Juan Boyer, another artist who was also well known in Ottawa. So there's a connection. So tonight, I'll be rather brief, maybe 30 minutes or 35 minutes, because actually the subject itself entails so many questions, and it can go in so many directions. I had to discipline myself and just find the actual topics that I could just explore tonight. And with your questions, we can go anywhere you want to go afterwards. So I'd like to say a few words about where I come from, because before I started doing Carillion photography steadily, I was actually very interested in the recording of memory traces in archaeological sites. So I did a lot of work in the Mayan jungles throughout Central America. Also, I did a lot of portraits, photography, landscape, but appearing and disappearing. And that was when we were still printing large format on beautiful Ilford fiber-based paper, and I would pull my own photos, 30 by 40, quite large photographs, maybe 100 of them I still have. Today we're not doing this so much anymore, and I've transformed my practice. But I'm still interested in these large format photos. So working in the memory field and in sites that are full of special energy and content, I came upon Auschwitz. I've been walking Auschwitz for about, I would say, 20 years now. It's a strange place to go to. It's, I would say, the archaeology of horror. And when I started walking Auschwitz, I couldn't quite situate myself photographically speaking. Lots of people had photographed about everything there was to photograph, the guard towers, the railroad tracks, all the elements that we have seen hundreds of times on the concentration camp site. And so I was sort of walking aimlessly sometimes, you know, trying to find, I know almost every square inch of that huge compound, which is several square kilometers. And I would ponder, especially on the trees that we see everywhere. And the trees at the back of the camp are actually rooted in the ashes of the victims. You can still see in the spring and the fall the ashes coming out of the earth. The earth is like breathing in and out the ashes. And so that became something of interest to me, because not only of interest, it was really a place where I could feel that there was a special energy and something very active happening, but my photography couldn't express it. I would photograph the tree trunks growing in the fields, and cutting them midterm so you could see that they were like persons or personalities that had been cut, and the bottom of the trees reflected that, and I felt that presence very much. So I was very frustrated not being able to represent more. So I decided to set out and discover another means of photographing and find an energy photography, something that I could actually photograph, literally, showing the energy fields. And that became my quest. So from Auschwitz in 1994, I became very interested in doing this kind of energy photography, but I had to find the tool. Out there? Okay, and then I'll move back to click my image whenever necessary. You can click? Okay. Is that better? Is this better?
I think it's better just having to stand.
A little more. That's okay. I don't mind standing. Just talk. You're right. So I began to seek for a tool that would allow me to photograph energy directly, because I couldn't express it through a still photograph. And the still photograph, although it does have its qualities, it could not express the full energy I was feeling. So I came upon electromagnetic photography. I won't say how, because it's a number of I think it was serendipity in a certain way, but I don't think things are accidental. You meet what you need to meet when you need it. And so I was looking for it, and I came upon the medium. I discovered this, and I felt that it could actually really express what I was trying to say with the thing. I started photographing plants, because you can actually photograph a lot of things with Kirlian photography. You can photograph fingers. I mean, I think you've all seen fingers, because it's one of the most common images of Kirlian photography. And there are a couple of other things that can be photographed. Unfortunately, with the fingerprints, it's very interesting for biomedical purposes, but it's quite boring visually. And so I started to work with plants on a regular basis. So I'm just going to move to the second. I have to find my arrow.
Yeah,
this is Auschwitz. This
little arrow down there.
Yeah, Auschwitz is really a place where you do have perspectives, and this is at one point I was working on the perspectives of Auschwitz, and these became actually very large backlit works that were exhibited in Montreal. There were 8 of these pieces, huge, 15 feet by 10 feet or something.
We can amplify you.
Okay. Right in the mic. Very large works in public space, but that's finished. That was done. So this is what actually this electromagnetic photography can do. Instead of I started collecting plants and doing a lot of plant images. I have thousands of them. And so by the time I had collected a few hundred, I realized that the plants could actually enter what I would call an energy herbarium. Instead of having just a successive number of plants, hundreds of photographs of plants, there was an organization that could be built around that, and a thought that could also evolve, because as you know, we have herbaria, and the herbaria are in natural museums all over the world. But I thought, now this is something that would be quite different, to have an energy herbarium or energy herbaria. The plants could be collected, not physically, but symbolically, and not symbolically, just photographically in an energy herbaria. And so I started doing this, I would say, about 7 or 8 years ago, where I realized that I could have categories of plants, I could have a number of varieties. And so I photograph mostly in the eastern forest of North America, or Laurentian forest around the Gatineau, and in my own garden. And so this is where most of the plants come from. What I want to show is that the energy, really from a little seed or a little ash seed, will give you this kind of photograph. Now, talk about quickly about process, because I know it's hard to understand if you're, you know, the process itself is not so simple. We are actually, to capture an image of energy, we actually have to induce a very, very potent electromagnetic field. I would say between 50,000 and 100,000 volts, that is, of course, tempered by amperage, which is low amperage, 15 amperes. And so that's why you don't get chilled.
15 amperes?
Yes.
From my bed. From Newman
Ampere. I think,
I think it's 15
yeah,
amperes.
It's not 15 amps.
It's not 15?
Yeah, 15 would be a lot.
Well, not to mention that if you had 50,000 volts at 15 amps, you'd probably take out most of the block.
Well,
that's a lot of watts.
I have to look into that because that's what is always given as the specs.
I'm an engineer.
Okay, you're an engineer. And what would it be? Less than that?
Probably 15 millivolts. Anything above 30 millivolts.
Millivolts.
You start melting glass.
Yes.
If you're up past, say, 1 amp. At 50,000 volts, you'd be putting arcs 2 or 3 feet across.
But the fuses that go in the fuse box.
Okay.
I know, but 15 is...
But that's 100 volts. Yeah.
You see... That's part of the problem with my engineer in the States, because the people who do these machines are actually very reclusive. Most of them are actually a little bit paranoid. And so you never get to the bottom of the story. They'll tell you... I know that the Russians, Valentina and Semyon Kirilian, who invented the machine, were actually using up to 500,000 volts. I mean, they burned themselves quite badly many, many times before they actually discovered what was the right ratio. So I have no idea. I'm not burning myself. I have a very good machine, but the guy never wanted to tell me how it was built or what were the specs. So, okay, I need some good information here. But the reality is that you need an electrode. Once you have that machine connected to the electrode is in a dark space because I use physical negatives. And the physical negatives that are on the electrode have the plant directly positioned on top of it. And when I induce the current, and there are a number of parameters that you can sort of control, not only the time, but you can control the polarities, etc. There are frequency, number of elements. And once you induce the current, it can be very short. I usually never go beyond 1 second. And the negative will absorb this. And when I develop it, it actually expresses what has been recorded. So what is recorded? I always lose the little... Yes. Okay. So what is recorded really is the energy body around the plant and through the plant. We could carry on a discussion about what is being recorded, and is it really the expression of a plant, of a field, a light field? Is it the expression of the humidity in the plant, etc.? Perhaps I can say that through all my experiments, there are really an infinite number of parameters. And it has rendered me very skeptical to a certain extent of our scientific naivete, because most of the experiments being carried out, whether they're in medicine or in science, always try to whittle down the cause to the effect, or relate the effect to one cause. When we do this kind of work, we actually see that all kinds of things happen. They are really linked to the actual living matter that is being examined. It could be dozens of factors influencing what we are seeing, but I will show just a few of the circumstances that I can sort of positively ascertain as being an effect. But this would be a fern. This is what it gives. Excuse me. So we actually have countless number of expressions of the field. There's no camera to capture this, so we're actually seeing the structure of the plant, the luminous structure. And one of the reasons that I work only in black and white is because I'm interested in recording light fields, but in a very in the essence of light, because you can actually do Carolian photography in color. And I have here, I will show you just a little later, a color image of Carolian photography. But the discipline of black and white sort of contains the subject matter to the light fields. There is no, I would say there's no spectacular effect. And I have been asked many times, why don't you do blow-ups, large images? It would be spectacular. And of course it would be. But my idea is that our relationship to this kind of work is a one-to-one relationship. We relate to a leaf, and we relate to what it is expressing. And so I refrain from blowing up elements or leaves that are just in their natural state. Here it's slightly bigger, of course, because this is happening on a screen. But in reality, they are small formats, and they never exceed the format of the negative set in a black background. So, yes, maybe you, Jake, because I lose it. So this is also the expression. It gives you, this gives a better idea of what happens when we capture the light fields in a closely up. And when we start seeing the light field, because the negative itself is just 8 by 10, but if we go inside the negative, we start seeing the negative completely differently. And I'll be showing a little video afterwards where we will get a sense of what happens when we travel inside these light fields, because light itself is a carrier of information. I think it permeates everything. And when we see how matter is being crossed in a certain way by light, it becomes a spectacular relationship between what is solid and visible and what we think is solid and visible, and everything else, the frequencies around us. Now, you probably, I mean, there are a lot of frequency effects now at work. We understand that several technologies are coming forward, and it's really interesting. I would say this is the effect of the 21st century. It's really a very interesting progress, because with the internet, with the idea of networking, with the idea of immateriality in communication and transfer of information, we have completely changed, I think, our approach to a lot of imaging. And Carolian photography is just one way of imaging. But when we think of MRIs, the MRI is really the magnetic resonance imaging. You have these hydrogen atoms that send back information on their frequencies to a computer that then translates everything into imagery. It's becoming more and more common. And so we now get a sense that frequencies are at the heart, I think, of what we understand of the world, rather than matter itself. Matter itself is a frequency. And I think Carolian photography can already show us that this is the kind of sensitivity, because as an artist, I'm not trying to build a scientific argument, far from me. But I think that we can develop the sensitivity that we live in this kind of frequency world. And put the next one on. Thank you. Okay, this gives us an idea of what happens when you do color Carolian photography. Color Carolian photography is very beautiful. The colors represent actually the nature of the gases that are being emitted. So you have certain gases like oxygen, like nitrogen, azote, I don't know in English what it is, with nitrogen. Okay, so you have several types of gases. Each gas has a different color, and therefore we can identify some activity around the plant. And in that small space between the plant and the actual air that is surrounding it, we also have an intense space where a lot of exchanges are occurring. And the color photograph gives us a sense of this kind of exchange. But I'm not really interested in doing color photography. For one thing, it's very hard to do now because you need to find the chemicals and the whole setup, whereas black and white is still very accessible. And the negatives in black and white are, of course, much cheaper. But beyond that, I just think that the color photographs are beautiful in themselves, but certainly don't carry the same intensity as the black and white. So I'd like to just to say a few things about the plant experiments. As you can see on this Plectranthus, this plant is very almost perfectly illuminated. It has a lot of spots and dots that we will see later on in a video. And the Kerolians, the couple, were often wondering what these light points were. Are they the points where, for instance, there's a lesser electrical resistance, much like an acupuncture, where you have a whole network of points? Is it because on these points are concentrated the essence of the plant, the essence of the plant itself? It could be a number of things. But anyways, I can only say that this one leaf was extremely radiant, and it comes from the botanical garden in Montreal. I think it was leading a happy and healthy life. There are many instances where you can actually see that the plants are reacting in a systematic way. Here we have an ash tree leaf, and we can begin to see that it has some spots where it's losing it. But it's strangely enough, it's still whole. Here it's already dried out and eaten by insects. And all leaves that are dried out and eaten by insects, of course, lose the sensitivity of their interface, and therefore they sort of begin to be black, etc. But that's not an absolute, because there is a way of restoring them. And when you lay the hands on these leaves, which is... Okay, I won't... Could you show this one? When you lay the hands, and this is no hocus pocus, I sort of just started practicing that because I thought that the leaves would respond. You lay the hands, if you take the leaf on the right... This is a Manitoban maple. And after 10 minutes of laying the hands, you get the image on the left, which is really a very energetic image. And so the interface, because now I'm considering that leaves are like interfaces, they react to whatever is happening with the human contact, and they can react very positively and immediately to this kind of activity. And I'll go even further. I know that people will think this is kind of... can you do this one? Yes, please. So we have here a small croton leaf, and it's been cut. It's been slashed throughout, and you can see the dark spots. This is always what happens when leaves are slashed. And then we go on, it's like this. And then we go on to the next one. And you can see how it is now becoming luminous again. And this is after 10 minutes of positive thinking, but I don't like the word positive thinking, of projections onto the leaf, asking it to come back to its healthy and natural light self. And this is... Oh, this is beautiful, but this is a field that has it too. But it does come back, and okay, it's not an accidental thing. You can actually, with thought, provoke a direct effect that can be photographed 10 minutes after, and I've done it over and over and over again, and it's not because the leaf is reacting. If I was photographing the leaf 10 minutes afterwards, and without doing anything, it would show itself to be attacked. But if I photograph it 10 minutes after thinking over it, it shows up like that. And we can talk about that a little later, because now American scientists in Stanford and MIT are actually developing models where they are trying to find the mathematical formula to integrate into our way of seeing reality. Thought has a form. It has not only a magnetic form. The Buddhist monks actually project very, very strong magnetic fields from the brain and the heart. But the thought has the capacity to transform matter. And this, I came across this, began to investigate more fully after I did these spontaneous experiments with Carolian photography. And I am now fully convinced that thought can actually modify matter. And we know that in healing and in several instances. Now, I have never tried the reverse, that is, trying to kill a plant with thought. If I stood 10 minutes asking the plant to die, what would happen? I can't tell you because I haven't tried it. Oops, sorry. Could you go back to this one, please? Yeah. So here we can see also an interesting phenomenon. The plant is visibly cut, and yet when you re-photograph it, it's photographed. It looks like a full hole. There is a separation, and yet the plant is still a whole. And this is also an interesting development that I keep seeing over and over again. That is that things are never separate. They are in the energy field. They are always coherent and united. And we can look at this one. You can see here that there's quite a separation, at least a centimeter, between the stems, the two ends of the stems, but it doesn't really affect the totality of the image and its bearing on the transfer of energy. Because light travels very freely, and it cannot be stopped by a mere separation. So in reality, we see separation, but in a light field, there is no such thing, apparently.
Seems like an intensification where it's cut.
The entry point for the electromagnetic field is below. It's not there. So it's elsewhere. But yeah, like it's an energy transfer. Yes. Now, what about death of plants? I photographed the death of plants. I have several series where you can see the plant dying over a period of 72 hours. I say 72 hours because it seems to be the actual span of the demise of a plant. If I cut the plant and if I start photographing it, 72 hours later, it will be completely dead. It will have disappeared from the negative. The only thing that you will see is the place where the electrical impulsion goes in, but there's nothing left. And it's quite interesting because the Russian scientist with whom I've been working in St. Petersburg, and he's called Dr. Konstantin Korotkov. Korotkov has invented machines. Russians keep inventing machines. They are very far ahead in this kind of field. And he has invented several new machines to integrate digital information. But the plant dies 72 hours after, just like a person. A person, he went to the morgue in St. Petersburg and started recording the fields of people who had been dead, who were dead in the morgue. And so he went and just wanted to check what would happen. And over 72 hours, because at the end of 72 hours, activity stopped. But for 72 hours, you would have a lot of activity coming from the body, mostly at night. At night, they had very high peaks. And the biological activity within the body was still going on. And at 72 hours, you came to a plateau, and what you would get, you would record nothing more. It was just a flat line. And it was very interesting for me to find out more about this, because the Korotkov could even tell how a person had died. If the person had committed suicide, had died a violent death, had died in her bed, or had a long illness, all the energy patterns were different according to that. And he didn't know what had happened to the person. He just scanned maybe hundreds of cases that he'd recorded, and then he detected that such things were similar, and he came out with that proposition, checked them out against reality, and yes, the people had died, like he said. So it's very interesting to see that death itself, the imprint in the body, is carried through, and it can give information about the way that the person has died. And eventually, even probably, we will be able to understand the thoughts that have been, that were perhaps in the person at the moment they died, because these things have a form. Okay, we can go to this one. Now, this is just a photograph of a rock. Yes, mineral. Minerals have an energy body, an energy field. It varies. And a very interesting scientist from the early 20th century in India, called Jagadish Chandra Bose, would actually record the reactions of minerals to poisons, to chloroform, to coal, to a number of things. And he believed that minerals could also die. And so this was one of the things that came out from his research. And I see different types of responses from minerals, but they are more systematic. I would say that I have never seen a mineral change. I can photograph this 50 times. But probably, if the mineral was poisoned, and that I will try soon, I would hate to poison a rock, but I would like to see if the rock responds to the poison. Now, these are small images of seeds. Seeds are the most vital elements of nature. They are always very luminous, and sometimes they are so luminous I can hardly record them because they bust the negative, and you really have to almost bring them down to minus 130 on Photoshop brightness just to get an image out, because the brightness is so huge. This one is controlled, but some of them are totally uncontrolled. Very, very vital. This is the heart of that seed that you can see, that was seen in the preceding image. And so I do also blow-ups of the light field, so that we begin to see what happens inside the light field. This is a light field from an ash leaf. Just beautiful, just expression of sheer energy. Now, this is the inside of a plectrantus, and we'll see a short video afterwards, just to see how when we travel inside of this light field, we see all kinds of configurations. Now, this is also interesting. It's just the stem of a periwinkle. Now, I'm always amazed by the reality of these photographs, because at some point, matter disappears. We don't have matter anymore. We just have holes and light going through holes. So what we perceive as being, this is a solid stem, but what we perceive as a solid stem is basically just an interface through which light travels, and then specific frequencies materialize, but there are other elements that don't materialize. And so we're actually walking through matter. So I would like to compare just a couple of images here, because what I've started doing is going with the digital tool inside my negatives, small negatives, going inside and identifying cosmic images. The very big is in the very small is in the very big, we all know that. But in reality, when we begin to see this, it is quite stunning. So this is inside one of the leaves, and then we go to the next image, and you can see the relationship with a cosmic panorama. I'm sorry, I don't have them side by side. Usually in the PowerPoint, they are side by side, but I couldn't handle it for this computer. The next one here is also is a poppy leaf, and so we are seeing one element of the poppy leaf, and the next image is also an image of a galaxy of some sort. I have the names, but I will not give you all these names. The next one is the seed that we have seen, and so it's quite particular. If we look at the next, I'm sorry, I should speak like this. Okay, we look into the next image. And here we have a faraway event in a galaxy, which is really has some similarities with what we've just seen. And so there is a relationship, I believe, between the cosmic events and the what is happening in the leaf. And for me, it is more of a holographic nature. That is, we are seeing in the very small, in the leaf, cosmic events, not through some kind of hocus pocus, but simply because the world itself is not a number of set elements, but a holographic reality. That is, the brain is interpreting frequencies that it is seeing in reality, and these frequencies belong to a wider universe. And so we are always traveling back and forth, but I think we're just locked into some kind of reality because this is the way we perceive reality. But perhaps if our brain starts understanding that reality is much bigger, we'll see it differently. And more and more now, studies and we are entering a reality where the brain will be working differently. The next image, this is just also the surface of a leaf. And just the point where the leaf and light meet. But we begin to see that there's no such thing as a definite boundary. Light is coming into the leaf. Leaf is going into the light. Where's the beginning? Where's the end of all of this? And this is fascinating because it really confirms that there are no such things as fixed boundaries. And the next one, yes, it gives us a sense of the same reality in outer space. These are columns of energy just rising and giving birth to galaxies. So I do some images that are also trying to bring together a number of the elements of cosmic nature. So this multiplication of planets, if you want, the incandescence of fire burning. This is a work at the Ottawa Gallery. Okay, these are installation works when I present the small works that are backlit, because I do a lot of backlit photographs. And this was presented in Contact Toronto recently. And it just gives a sense of the herbarium. The herbarium is presented in a backlit fashion. This is another type of installation at the Métis Gardens in northern Quebec, where the video is presented, and then the small backlit images are also creating a space of contemplation. See, this is the type of backlit you know well, Lily. Backlit images. Okay, and I don't only, sometimes I go off track and I do work with an electrocardiogram. And so I plug the plants on an electro, and it's very interesting because I have never, I've gone to major hospitals working with cardiologists and asking them what is happening to this plant, because it is reactive. And if it doesn't have a nervous system, it doesn't have a heart, what is it reacting to? And we know that people, when you put people on an electrocardiogram, the noise around the room, etc., doesn't affect the electrocardiogram. It's really the movement of the heart. And so when we plug a plant, it can go wild, it can go flat. It has every aspect of an actual reaction to cardiogram. An egg has the same reaction. It's very interesting to see an egg reacting and being recorded. So I do several of these recordings. That's it. And perhaps I would just like to show you two short films, it won't be long, videos, that will give an idea of what happens when you travel inside plants and what happens when you see actual vibrations from plants. So we'll do the first one. That's small. Yeah. So this is a small 2-minute video. I have a new machine that has come from Europe and can finally record the light fields live. And so I do get the live reaction of plants as I record them. So this is a leaf that is reacting to all kinds of situations. It's not on a branch. It's single, but it does have that energy. And the second one also has been cut, but still reacting in a very dynamic fashion. It's the same leaf, but answering from all sides and different. And nature is really actually all the time like this, but we could not bear to, I guess, to see even one tree like this. It would be too much for our vision. We would faint. So it's just a small clip. And the second video I would like to show rapidly, if we go to Mirrors of the Cosmos, you can go perhaps to... Yeah. Now, Mirrors of the Cosmos, we won't go through the whole thing, but I just want to show you one or two leaves that are being visited with my digital tool. And this was in the Botanical Garden in Montreal. And I just took the negative of the leaf and decided to enter into the negative with the digital tool. And it becomes a travel in light, simply. So we don't have texture of a, we don't see the texture of the leaf anymore, we just see pure light. there is a soundtrack, but it doesn't matter. No, no, we won't. We can't hear it anyways. But so I'm fascinated by the frontiers and the outer limits. Where is the outer limit of this leaf? It's actually becoming very, very unclear. So I wonder if we can speed it up and go to the next one. There are five elements, so if we go, is there a way to speed that one up? Or not? No, not really.
I can drag it.
Drag it, yeah. Okay, leave it to this one. This one is different. It has a different atmosphere. It's another type of leaf. And this is really very strong light around the leaf rather than in the leaf. So again, we can't really tell where the edge of the leaf is really. It's being submerged by light. And it becomes just like a big incandescent sun in a certain way. And there's a relationship between the eruptions on the sun and this type of work. We'll just hit the top and then move on. Solar tempests are something like this. Now you can move on to the last one. This gives an idea of what it is. Move on to the last one. This is like volcanoes, cosmic volcanoes. To the next one. Skip the rock. This is the rock. Okay, can you go back a little bit on this one? Okay, this last one we can just check out. Because there is a leaf under here, but doesn't show. It's the fern, but the rest of the fern is there. It's not showing. Just advance a little more to the top. Just go a little ahead. Yeah, okay. So leave it there, I think. It will come. So this is basically working from an 8x10 negative and just going inside what is recorded in the negative.
Some areas that seem like they're part of the structure, but they're very black. I don't know.
Yes, and it's very strange. It's what is being lit up, what is not lit up. Uh-huh. It's going to come. You can come to the. It's coming to the top.
I can't have too much of it, but there's like a small amount of it.
So we're about to hit pure light, and then it looks like a solar flare. Like these look like total solar flares. Now the question is, are these artifacts or not? And I don't think so. I think they are actually expressing a state of the plant that is extremely luminous, and depending on the point of view we have, because we had a very close-up point of view, and now the point of view is becoming more realistic as we go away from the plant, away from the thing, it will go back to its obvious state, and then it goes back into an image. It becomes the image it is in the botanical garden again. But depending on the point of view, we can actually see reality differently. I know this has several implications, and I think it's better if I answer some questions, because it can go so many ways. I'm interested now in the holographic world, how these images are really basically holograms, and though they are flat images, and how this transforms our vision of the world. And as an artist, I think that our aim is really to give a vision of the world and to transform visions. And I truly believe that if we understand the reality of light and what it does, we will see objects, and we will see everything differently. And so this is my new interest in working. And I'm sorry I can't go in depth, because I get deconcentrated, and this is really it's a hard subject to broach. And if I talk just technicalities, it's okay. But if we get into concepts like holographic universe and such things, it demands a little more concentration, and I'm sorry, I can't really give it fully because there's noise. But that's okay. It's a different kind of reality.
Sorry for the distraction.
No, you don't have to be. This is a reality. You told me that it was.
Yeah.
And so
it's been various.
I do have a question about technique, though.
Yes, surely.
How are you attaching the electrodes to the plant?
How do you attach?
How do you attach the electrodes to the plant?
Yes, one electrode just to the stem.
With a clip?
Yes, with an alligator clip.
Okay.
Because it has to be grounded, of course.
Could I ask you something just as a point of clarification?
Yes.
When you attach this carillion machine to the plant and generate the reaction, is the reaction, is what you are recording, is it a document of a plant, or is it a document of the reaction generated by the machine?
That's the question, the far-reaching question, because is it also a document of your interaction with the plant? It's really a document of so many things, because I've started just listing everything that could influence a reaction, a response, etc. And I think I have up to now at least 50 or 60, not causes, but situations, influences that can influence the response. And so this idea that there is such a thing as one cause, one effect is so naive that it's beyond comprehension. Even medically, I understand that you have to, you know, sometimes link cancer to cigarette smoking and such things, and you need to have only one influence and one effect. But in reality, there's no such thing. You have dozens of effects. The phase of the moon has an effect. The time of the day, the way the sap is going up the tree, the moment of the year, the solar flares. Actually, when there are solar tempests, and we are presently in a period of solar tempests, it started 2 years ago, and it will go on for another 2 or 3 years, and then we have a little lull, and then it starts again. But when we have these very powerful electromagnetic tempests, the plants respond in a completely different way. There are years when I have recorded plants, and it was in between these electromagnetic storms. I had nothing. I could record maybe 50, 60, 70 plants, negatives, and nothing appeared on the negative. And then I get a good year when there's a lot of storms, electromagnetic storms, and the plants are very, very active. They're responding to different situations. They're being very specific in their response. So I don't have all the tools to find that, but at least from experience you can see that there are hundreds of influences.
Could I ask just a little follow-up question? When you have your setup in place, you have your plans attached to the machine, and you are going to take an exposure.
Yes.
Right? How do you decide the extent of the exposure? Is it 1 second, half a second, and how do you decide how long you want to expose?
I usually expose it for 1 second, and at 30 or 40 kilovolts, and I have a frequency also. I have a polarity, because you can have the north or south polarity, so a positive or negative polarity, and it makes a difference in the way the plant expresses itself. So there are all these particulars.
And you record these things on negatives or on
transparency? I record them I link them to the negative, so I know what has happened into a negative polarity or positive, and the type of, I usually record the humidity, the temperature, and all the other elements of the all the other parameters.
Wind speed,
no.
No, I'm just thinking, no,
but when the plant was photographed, so if it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon,
these people who are inventing and using the Carillion machines, the ones who actually, what do they photograph?
Oh, the people who initially invented the machine. Semyon and Valentina would record fingerprints, because in Russia.
But what are the people who are making machines now?
What are they? They use it for biofeedback, because you actually get very good responses. There's a doctor in Germany called Peter Mandel, and Peter Mandel has recorded the whole repertoire of answers you get from fingers, and he has linked them to organs and to specific kinds of illnesses. And I can attest from personal experience that there is such a thing. His protocols are as precise as X-rays. If we read an X-ray and we don't know what the protocol is, well, you know, an X-ray is an X-ray. You have to understand what you're reading when you're reading, and you must have a system for reading. This is why these things are efficient. The same thing with keratin photographs. If you record fingertips and toes, because this is what they record, and they are usually recording acupuncture channels and meridians and a number, making relationships between these things, they make a lot of sense. And you get protocols that are very exact. They are so exact that in Russia, they don't have money, sometimes to buy these very expensive MRI machines and others. And so they have Carillion machines. And the doctors using the Carillion machines are extremely, extremely precise in their analysis. And they can actually see cancers way before they appear. And I must say that I saw my own cancer before it appeared, and I didn't know it was that. Yes, they appear as, I had a, not a very, very serious one, but I did have one. And it appears as little balls, you know, like you have a cluster of balls. And this can be degenerative disease, but it is also cancer. And it appeared exactly on the place corresponding to the organ where the cancer was manifesting. But this manifestation happened, I recorded it 4 years before the actual manifestation. I had the protocols of Peter Mandel, and I knew that this was related to a degenerative disease, but I was not sufficiently aware of what was happening, because had I known that, I would have gone to Germany to see the doctor and have an interpretation right away, you know?
Yeah, right.
I saw this and I thought, well, you know, this is what it looks like. It looks like a degenerative disease, but so, you know, what?
So do you do this in the dark or are you...
In total darkness. This is one of the difficulties of doing photography with plants, because you actually have to position them, and they position themselves, because with the electrode and with the manipulations in the dark, you need to be, you were blind, like, blinded.
So it's not a film holder type of thing?
No. And you cannot actually really determine what will happen, because the plant always moves a little bit. And so sometimes it's a bit awkward. And this is why a lot of these plants have a very frontal look. I actually work a lot on adding and work on the positioning of the plant, but it's hard to achieve because you never know which way it's going to go, and it takes dozens of I would say it takes about 10 images to get one good one, and sometimes even 20 in this business. So it's total darkness, and then you develop the negative also in the dark.
But 8x10 negatives, that must get pretty costly too.
Yes. So they're not always very successful.
The video, the live energy, that must be something different.
That's a new machine, and that is different, because you actually position the leaf on the plate. You can work in light. You don't need darkness. And once the leaf is animated, it will express itself for 7 seconds. I cannot do it longer. So it's a 7-second expression that is captured on a Canon DSDL5, a very good Canon video. It's not a Canon camera. It's a photo camera. But it's with the video function on the, it's not DSL, it's the D5 or D5.
So it's a DSLR with video.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And it's a very good recording of such a thing. But the machine is conceived to capture that.
But some of the moving pictures was of branches of cedar.
Yes, that's really in the forest.
Yeah.
And that's how it's behaving. Forest, when you have light, just the light of the water reflecting on the branches, it becomes almost hysterical sometimes.
Right.
It's a movement that is a bit akin.
Putting electrodes on the tree?
No, for the when you see these very active branches, this is actually in nature as it happens. I wanted to show that the activity in nature was somewhat similar to...
How do you get an electronic image without attaching something to the tree?
Oh, it's not an electronic image. This is a reality image.
What?
It's a reality image. It's actually reality that it's activated like this. But it's so fascinating to see. I rarely see it. And there's only one spot where I've been able to record it. But when you see this activity, it's really... happening.
Well, you had one image there looking down into the water.
Yes.
I've seen that.
Yes.
In Lake Superior, I remember. And
exactly.
Then said, if you had branches above that, you would have to,
this kind of, kind of. Yes. And it's very interesting because it relates to the other energy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
But my interest, I must say, right now is I'm writing a book, and the book is actually quite clear on a number of these issues, and it just reflects my interest really in the holographic nature of the universe. So art, I guess that's what I can say.
I have to admit, in anticipation of this, I tried some experiments at home. I couldn't quite get a reasonable image.
Did you build something yourself?
No, I already had a 75,000 volt device in my basement. Doesn't everybody?
yes, we all have that.
But I found after just a few seconds, the actual plant almost cooked. Yes. Yes, it actually was less than pleasant.
Oh, yes.
And anything with a thinner coating just burnt straight through.
Uh-huh.
How high was the amperage?
It was low. But at the same time, it got to the point where this was arcing, the switch gave me a nice shock.
Yes.
But less than impressive results of something that I thought about it before, but I always wanted to try. And I think this is I'll have to try more.
Well, you know, I can tell you that unless you get a very calibrated, very well-calibrated instrument, which is hard to come by because most of the people who develop them are in the U.S. Well, some are in the USSR, in France, one in Brazil, very in England. And they're actually quite secretive in the way that
they're not very difficult to build.
It's not to build, it's to calibrate. I have seen many, and most of the images that I see coming from these machines are below par. The machine I have is so exact, and the level of details you get is so profound that it comes from one of the founders of one of the early practitioners of Tyrolean photography. And I could never get the black and white images I get from just from video. Video is not the same, right? When you have just a specific images on negatives, it's not at all the same as when you record video.
Yeah.
It's like a video.
Well, the resolution of an 8x10 negative is huge. Yes, it's an
yes.
picture.
Yeah.
No, lovely picture.
Yeah.
Well, it's just that when you see hundreds of them together, it makes sense. And it's a herbarium. I'm thinking that a botanical garden might be interested at some point to think nature differently. And in Montreal, they were actually very interested. So I did a large installation. But
so when you apply the voltage, is there visible light?
Yes.
So you could photograph it with a digital camera if you had a good rig.
I tried because I wanted to make videos. You know, I wanted to make a video. I took night vision videos and very, very sophisticated videos. But it's still not sufficiently sensitive to capture it.
You're old.
But if you are exposing for a second,
yes.
Then you can expose for a second as well.
You will
get two.
Yes, or five actually. I think that's my limit. you will get. You would get perhaps, and that's what you would get, the flares, which are, the flares are violet, blue. You would get the flares. but you would not get the highly detailed interior of the plant. You would never get that from photographing on top of it. The principle of the of putting the plant directly on the negative and inducing the field makes the negatives work like a photogram. So you're getting the effect of a photogram. So it's direct contact, and the direct contact is very, very detailed. But just photographing the flares is like
there has to be a way.
Fuzzy.
If there's an actual link coming up, there has to be a way to photograph it.
You can photograph it, but you'll never get the level of detail. I tried so many things. I tried night vision video. I tried highly sensitive. Nothing. You know, I didn't even get a spark.
It's direct contact. It's like,
I know.
You
know.
The direct contact makes it. Because the light just comes to me. But we have to try.